This is our fifth day in a series of how to prevent violence here at Holden Village. It's the
we're trying to prevent people from killing each other here at Holden Village.
Maybe you succeeded.
Yeah. No. So this is for the purpose of the recording. It's August 5th, 2011. I know that all of you know that.
I forgot the dates.
Yeah, well, it's kind of nice to forget the dates, isn't it? Well, it's great to have you all here, and I really want to thank you. Many of you have been loyally attending this, and I'm really delighted that you're here, and we can kind of summarize some things today if you'd like. I want to have plenty of opportunity for you to ask questions. The goal of today is really, you know, to try to talk through what you can do in your own lives, and that might be through your school, through your community, or through your church, and we'll kind of go through all of these. I certainly want to encourage you to raise questions as we go through the different parts of the course today. I am planning to get into a little bit more deeply the question of intra-faith engagement with religious extremists, and I think that many of us, at least within our faith communities, sometimes in our larger, you know, civil society, are confronting people who are, you know, kind of listeners of hate radio, people who are really angry about having Muslims, particularly among their in their midst, and the Christian, our co-religionist Christians, are really people that we need to kind of try to listen to where they're coming from, what is in their heart, what are they trying to deal with, but also try to relate with them at a spiritual level about what they're struggling with. So we'll get into that in some detail. We'll talk about ceasefire, particularly as it relates to gang violence, and how you might have a ceasefire affiliate in your community. We'll talk about a little bit more about school tip line. I know there have been people who wanted to hear more about that. I do have a list of resources here, websites, videos, evaluations, and books. And I'm gonna pass those out at the end, but if any of you need to leave early, feel free to grab one of these. I'll put it right here on the table. I've learned as I've taught over the years that you never pass things out during class. It just distracts everybody. So, okay. So we had talked a bit about the distinction between interfaith and intrafaith engagement, okay? Keep in mind that if you look at religious extremism, the struggle usually boils down to religious extremists against religious moderates. Not so much, a lot of people are angry that the Muslim moderates haven't stood up more forcefully to the Muslim extremists. And, you know, there's been a lot of concern about that. At the same time, after having lived in Jerusalem for 3 years, I've seen what I would call Armageddon Christians do a great deal of harm in Jerusalem. They have something called the Christian Embassy. They believe that the second coming of Christ should be heralded in, and that if that happens, then the end of the world will be facilitated, and that they need to do that. So they need to help Israel overtake all the Palestinian territories. And so people don't realize this, but some of the Palestinians are Christian. A lot of the Christian Palestinians, unfortunately, have left the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and the old city of Jerusalem. And as far as that, all of eastern Jerusalem, they're withering away in part because they feel like they're pushed between the Jewish people and the Muslim people. But internationally, the Christians are not standing up to their fundamentalist Armageddon arm. And what that's doing is it's hostilizing the Muslim Palestinians against the Christian Palestinians. I mean, if you think of this, the Christian Palestinians are the original descendants of the first Christians at the time of Jesus Christ. And in a sense, they feel like they've been abandoned by the world. So oftentimes people will talk about, oh, we've seen the Muslim extremists, whether it's Hamas or the Islamic Brotherhood or whomever, getting out of hand. And so what they want to do is that they, remember, the white circle is moderates. What they want to do, let's say that religion A is Judaism, religion B is Islam, religion C is Christianity. So the moderate Christians, oftentimes what they want to do is that they want to lash out at the Muslim extremists, or they want to lash out at the Jewish extremists. And what that does is it just creates a lot more tension. And so the research on this is showing that really what we need to do is moderates need to engage with the extremists. They're co-religionist extremists. And they also need to build networks with people who are moderates of other faiths. So here we've got communication across here, right? Communication there among the moderates, but we've got monitoring of aggression. So this moderate leader is monitoring the aggression over here of the Muslims and the aggression over here of the Christians, but they're communicating that aggression to the moderates of the people of that faith tradition. So basically, the assertiveness needs to happen among co-religionists. And it's really an important point. So in our own situation, we need to be engaging in respectful but also assertive ways with the hate radio people, with the Armageddon Christians, etc. Rather than pointing the finger to the Jewish people and saying, you better stop oppressing the Palestinians, or pointing a finger to the, you know, radical Muslims or the Muslims and saying, you better get a handle on your suicide bombers. And sure, we need to communicate to people that we're frustrated by these things, but our main focus should be on our co-religionists, because it is there that we can engage in a respectful dialogue that is theological and spiritual. Because oftentimes people are, in fact, propelled on the basis of, it might be a very narrow interpretation of a sacred text, a very distorted view of a theological reasoning or of a doctrine. And so that's the really tough part. It's like I say, you know, this part, interfaith dialogue with moderates, you know, it's about as enjoyable as going to a wine and cheese party, right? It's easy. It's fun. That's the easy part. The hard part is confronting a co-religionist. And I give the example of, you know, confronting... let's say that your brother-in-law says a racist joke at a Thanksgiving dinner. You have, and you decide that you really need to confront your brother-in-law for doing that. You might want to do it in private. You might want to do it in public. It's probably better to do it in private. But is it a pleasant thing to do? No, you'd rather be, you know, eating your apple cobbler or whatever, you know? You don't want to be standing there confronting your brother-in-law saying, you know, it's really not a good idea to... I mean, we kind of went beyond that with, you know, the whole civil rights thing where, you know, yes.
So we have a friend, a pastor, who says, don't bother arguing with them. You'll never convince them.
Well, that's a good point. I think that, I think, and that's one of the problems. You know, people, the only way, for instance, in my opinion, the only way you're ever going to get peace in the Middle East is if moderate Jews can engage in what theologians call hermeneutic dialogue with rabid Jews.
Well, I'm thinking of us against the Armageddon Christians.
Okay, I think the same is true. The only way that we're ever going to deal with the people in the Christian embassy in Jerusalem and on hate radio is if we say, okay, I understand that you've got a lot of anger. I understand that you're feeling hate. I understand that you've been reading the gospel this way, and you can't make peace by excluding people and acting like they're a bunch of idiots. It doesn't help. So, I mean, I can empathize with the pastor, but I, and sure, it's true, you can't, what you don't want to do is call up on hate radio and turn yourself into a sacrificial lamb, because you can't really have a respective dialogue there. But you can, you know, get the Rush Limbaughs of the world into a room and say, Rush, buddy, hey, we need to talk a little bit, because you're getting a little bit out of hand here. And do you really think that the gospel means that? We understand that, and I'm not, it may not be Rush Limbaugh, maybe some televangelist. Do you really believe that the overwhelming thrust of the gospel of Christ means that? Yes.
My experience in listening to folks like that, Joe, is that they don't talk about the gospel. They talk Old Testament stuff.
Yeah. Right.
You listen sometimes to the radio station I was listening to on a motorcycle or on a car trip.
Yeah.
Coming back to Spokane, and the start of the show was we're gonna do Matthew 16, the Sermon on the Mount.
Right.
That's the text for today.
Right.
I listened for 45 minutes, and it was Ezekiel and da da da.
Right.
Not one thing about Matthew. And it didn't say Matthew once, and at the end, thank you for listening to our show about the Sermon on the Mount.
Right.
True. I mean,
except for Revelation.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. I mean, a lot of that too is okay. So
you're not convoluting the gospel.
Right.
You're not preaching the gospel.
Right. It's really kind of a mess in terms of appeal towards Old Testament, appeal to civic virtue or constitutional fidelity. It's a challenge, and I'm not saying that this is easy. In fact, we had a project when I was in Jerusalem. We brought together students, Muslim students, Christian students, and Jewish students from Hebrew University, Hebron University, and Bethlehem University, an equal number of each, an equal number of women and men, and we called it the Track 2 Anti-Incitement Project, because there's all kinds of religion incitement. And we were trying to deal with anti-incitement at a mid-level leadership level, not the people who are in the Knesset, etc. Okay, so we said, okay, the first thing we need to do is get a handle on how extensive is this. And they went onto the internet. They couldn't believe the amount of incitement in Hebrew and Arabic and English towards people of other faith traditions. But then they started going to, for instance, religious events where kind of the rabid religious leaders were, and they felt threatened. For them to speak up, they felt like they would have been mobbed. Mm-hmm. So it's not an easy thing. I mean, I'm not saying that this is a panacea. It's very difficult. In fact, it's dangerous in some circumstances. In Sri Lanka, when I was working with the Foundation for Coexistence there, there were people who had to be evacuated from places. They had to take staff members away from places because of the strength of the religious passion. So it's not easy. I mean, people can be and have been killed by speaking up to their co-religionists, and it's not easy. But I guess what I'm saying is, that's the hard work. If you want to go to the wine and cheese parties, that's your business. But if you really want to do something, it's co-religionist. And it's urging your moderate Jewish friends to deal with their rabid rabbis, and your moderate Muslim friends to deal with their rabid muftis. Yeah.
What you're saying is absolutely right. The issue is, you have to go to the right people. Because you have people on the fringe who I think are acting in good faith, sincerely believe in what they believe, and you can have a conversation with those folks.
Right.
Because we have a Bible study in our church where we are on far ends of the spectrum, and quite frankly, a lot of us are coming because we're discussing people of good faith.
Right.
And if you can find the people of good faith and have that conversation, which is going to be a long conversation, not a short one.
Right.
And then they can start influencing, because the people on the radio, they're just, I don't know how many of them are acting in good faith.
Right.
And it seems that's kind of where we have to be targeted.
Yeah, you kind of have to identify who are the relatively thoughtful leaders in this group. And you have to try to deal with them, because, and my experience is, you need to do it kind of behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. not in a public setting, because mm-hmm. you'll get them into their backs up against the wall.
Exactly.
And you want to be respectful towards them. Yes?
On the Christian side and the hate radio side, where's the funding coming from? Because I sometimes wonder if talking to the people providing the funding, I mean, is it all grassroots? Is it just a lot of people with a lot of hate giving money to support these services? Or is it the Procter and Gamble's and these huge corporations that see listenership and so give money? I mean,
that's a great question. I know in the case of Jewish extremism, there are huge corporations, many of them American, who are funding those groups. And I really don't know about the hate radio groups. I mean, that's a great question.
I know Gold Bond is responsible for a lot of it.
Gold Bond?
Well, the powder manufacturer. I mean, you hear constantly, yeah. It seems like every commercial break.
Okay.
But, I just wonder as Christians if, you know, maybe that's an avenue to talk to. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's.
I don't know.
Yes. It's corporate sponsors. I mean, if you listen to who's sponsoring the ads, and that's where the funding for hate radio comes from. You know, when Glenn Beck went too far, his corporate sponsors started to drop him. I mean, they pitched him off the air in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
And so if the corporate sponsors feel the heat and they stop sponsoring this, then more moderate people of better will rather than sort of paid entertainers
uh-huh.
will appear.
Well, it's a tough challenge, but I just want to urge all of you to really consider how you deal with it and if you're going to do it, I really recommend that you form a group of people who can kind of be a fellowship in the Christian spiritual discipline sense, a fellowship of people who are prepared to dialogue and to help each other with this process. You don't want to do it alone. If it becomes threatening or unpleasant, you want to have other people to work with. So I really recommend that. Okay, I want to add, this is kind of a quiz because, you know, when you teach college students, you always want to teach them certain things. And if you want to get beyond kind of the regurgitation model of testing and see if they can move to a level of critical thinking and synthesis, you ask some tough questions. So this is a tough question that I'm asking. I'm testing to see how well you're doing here. So will somebody read this this quote, please? It's in gray. Who would like to read it? Go ahead.
Referring to the revolution in Libya, pluralism seems assured. Women still mostly cover their hair, but neither in the East nor in the Nafusa Mountains is Islamism much in evidence. In Bir Ghanem, few of the 40 frontline fighters pray regularly.
Okay, what's wrong with this quote? Yes.
You are assuming that it's Muslim, that it's caused by Islam, and you're not thinking about all the tribal things and everything else going on there.
That's a good point, yes. Anybody else?
The pluralism.
Pluralism in what? Define that.
How do you define it?
Well, I think it may be more, I'm thinking of more pluralism as more secularism.
Okay.
And then, despite the fact that this isn't maybe a religious tradition, there's maybe more of a cultural tradition that's causing some of those practices.
Right. Right. Yes.
I think it refers more accurately to tribal pluralism. And the anecdotal evidence here refers to cultural practices among the multitudes of different tribes. But the revolution itself ends up becoming dominated by the Islamists, I think, is still very much up in the air.
Yes.
Is this assuming that pluralism is assured because this is not being dominated by Islam?
Uh-huh.
Because in the old days, Islam used to living in Islam, Islamic countries assured pluralism.
Uh-huh, right.
And when I'm reading this, I'm saying, well, the Islam, while they still carry their hair, people aren't praying and
so right. The whole. Right. Okay, anybody else?
In a sense, what this, first of all, you get an A. But in a sense, what this says is that let's rejoice if people are losing their religion. Right?
Yeah.
It's kind of like these people are Muslims, and we would rather that they not be devout Muslims rather than be Muslims at all. It's kind of like we hope that they're going to be secular. Okay? So here's the way that I try to understand this. You know, you talked about it. You know,